Okay, for most of you, you kind of know what that's about. All things are not as they appear, because that's where we closed out this morning and said we'd pick up there again this evening. And putting this together, I knew that it wasn't going to fit in one sermon, and which is okay. So it was just finding a good breaking point. But we're noticing from the fourth chapter of the book of Genesis how that Cain and what he was, in a sense, even influencing his family to be was to survive. Cain had a strong survival instinct, which I suppose most of us have as well. We just kind of like to survive, and there are a lot of things that we, you know, would do to survive. Well, Cain, of course, might even go further than what you and I would do and in order to survive, but we find that in doing that, he's setting up just pretty much what people do when they think of the kingdoms of men and the kingdoms of earth, and that is, you know, setting up a legacy for themselves and be able to get as much out of this life as they, you know, can possibly get. And when we look there at the grandsons of Cain, and we saw there, let's just see here, we're going to be noticing tonight the consequences following Cain's tradition, but when we saw there where that Cain started it all because he just would not submit himself to the desire of God to worship the way God had instructed him to worship. He just wasn't going to do it. And God had told him, he says, you can bring all this under control. We can make all this right, in a sense. And you know, we can proceed from that. You can rule over these passions and these desires that you're having. And yet, not only did not do that, but for whatever reasons and, you know, to whatever degree that such jealousy could overtake someone, that he then would raise up and he would kill his own brother. He'd murder his own brother. And that's what he did. And then, you know, he begins to learn what all of this is, you know, it's going to entail. How is this going to work out? You know, maybe he just thought he was going to rid himself of his problem, but God stepped in and said, no. He says, you know, this is not allowable. I'm not allowing this. And so we see then where Cain became that wanderer. And as he then wandered, he found a place where he could, you know, settle and raise a family. He built a city there and he raised a family. And we saw the consequences of that, how that under his influence that they sought prosperity over spirituality. And when we look at these three things, they really fit pretty well with the desires of the, you know, that we established, or that founding fathers established when they founded this country. And that is, you know, for us to have the freedoms and the liberties and without restraint to be able to, you know, be prosperous and to be able to enjoy life and to be able, you know, to progress. And I don't think any of us look at those and go, well, boy, you know, that was just terrible of them to do. You know, we appreciate that. And so as we saw this morning, that's not necessarily wrong to be prosperous or, you know, to seek things that are enjoyable and entertaining, or even, you know, to progress and have, you know, new things and inventions that make our lives easier and enable us, you know, to get more work done even in less time, type of thing. But the stress that we were making this morning is that they were learning all of this to place it over this idea of seeking God and knowing God. And so they sought all that, you know, over spirituality. And it's kind of interesting. Our founding fathers, and this isn't, you know, a history lesson. I don't know it enough in detail to really, you know, to give you a history lesson. But you know, I know the big picture. And because I have seen the details, I just haven't committed those as much to memory as I have like this, you know, like the Bible. But maybe, you know, these fellows understood these things. I mean, they were Bible students. A lot of which, what they did was based upon what they had gained in their understanding from the Bible. And so one of the things that they noted is that, you know, that they believed that God had prospered them in establishing this country and in founding it and going forth. And they believed that it was God's, you know, freedom that He had given to man that allowed man, you know, these abilities to be able to, you know, be prosperous and happy and seek out, you know, the joys in life. Because on the other hand, they also then often reminded people about God and you know, making sure that we don't forget God in this equation. They were very careful about making sure that the government would not establish a religion that they then said, you have to follow this way. You know, you have to worship just the way that the government dictates. And so they took that power from the government and said, the government can't tell you how to, but the government can't tell you not to either. And so the government gives you this freedom, this expression of freedom of religion. And so they even put that then, you know, in our Constitution and our Bill of Rights, you know, very significantly talk about God. But here we're seeing God's just totally removed from this equation, isn't He? And we find that you see a strong similarity, and we're going to return to it here in just a little bit at the conclusion of our lesson. But doesn't it really look very similar to what you read in the first chapter of Romans? And where that you go that, well, they knew God, but they just wouldn't recognize God, you know. They wouldn't give Him thanks. And they started reasoning in their vain minds, you know, and you know, having this idea that they thought that they could figure out what would be better and what would be right versus, you know, what God had revealed. And so God says, you know, they became fools in that. And they did worship things. And when He talks there about the likeness of, you know, an image of corruptible man and birds, four-footed beasts and creeping things, we don't have any indication where Cain worshipped idols, but that's what they worshipped. That is, they worship the elements of this world, of this earth, and that's what you know, worldliness is. Even people who do not believe in God and say they don't believe in religion and that type of thing, they still bow down to the elements of this world. You know, they still attend to those things quite significantly. And so what we have then, like in the 24th verse of Romans chapter 1, is wherefore God gave them up. God gave them up. God let them live this way. To the lust of their hearts, to the desires of their hearts, you know, to their, you know, itsy bitsy little heart that, you know, that wanted to do whatever it wanted to do. God said, okay, you just can go out and do it. And so that's where we are. And so when we look at that, like I said, it all looks pretty good because world-wise, the family of Cain was doing well. Worldwise, you could look at them and go, man, they're on the ball. They have it. They're workers. They're producing. They are, you know, becoming wealthy. They are entertaining. They are, you know, inventors they are engineers and they are designers and they're building a great world. And, you know, man has sought to do that generation after generation after generation. You know, I told you once before about how I'd heard, and it just made so much sense that as Satan seems to replicate, you know, what God has given, but, you know, with worldly things, and how that people so look forward, you know, and read like, the writings and the theories of Darwin, because man wants to know where he came from. I mean, our government even donate, it's probably not the right word, but they grant large sums of money to institutions and organizations to try to find out where we came from, look into the stars and look into our past and see if we can figure out how we arrived here. And so, you know, Darwin becomes the answer of Genesis 1 and 2 for man. And then man realizes that he struggles with his ideas and his thoughts, and with that comes guilt. And so man worships psychology then, and psychiatry. You know, he worships the father of it, in a sense, Freud, and you know, wants to study that so that we can interpret our dreams and know what this means, and you know, and whether we hate our parents or not, you know, and the reason why we're the mess that we are is because, you know, of our parents and things like that. And so Freud becomes very important. And then, you know, even today, you see all these young people, these college students and such, that think that Marx is great, and they read the works of Karl Marx. And that's because all of these are trying to create a utopian world, you see, a replacement for God. And we see, in a sense, you know, that all that looks, you know, like it is progressing, you know. It looks like man is, you know, developing and evolving is the term, you know, of course, they really like to use. And that our evolution, you know, of man has reached this point where we don't need God. And when we close this morning, you know, it kind of looked like Cain and his family had it together, didn't it? So what we're noticing tonight is that progressive, but not positive. They did progress. They did accomplish a lot of good things, but it really didn't help mankind. And one of the ways you can look at that is names. You know, names say a lot, especially at this time, because they name their children in respect to, you know, some quality or some character or maybe even some goal that they had, you know, for their children. And by that, names had a meaning. And so you take like Cain and him taking here and having his first son. It says verse 17, and Cain knew his wife. This is Genesis 4. And Cain knew his wife, and she conceived and bare Enoch. And he built a city and called the name of the city after the name of his son Enoch. And so we see there that he named him Enoch. And that sounds good, because we know another Enoch that was one of the sons, as far as going down through the lineage, one of the great-great-grandsons of Seth. And his name was Enoch too, wasn't it? And what's the description of him? His description is that he walked with God, isn't it? And his name meant, and still means, dedicated. And so we find that when Cain named his son Enoch, he was calling him dedicated. And so that doesn't sound so bad, does it? And so we kind of like, okay, well, what's he dedicated to? Now, I don't have time to get into, and I think maybe we've talked about a little bit before, and if we haven't, Lord willing, we'll just come back to it sometime and talk a little bit about it. But with Enoch, and by the time of Enoch, Enoch knew that the world was getting really, really bad. There's evidence of that in the Scriptures. And as he knew that it was getting really bad, we find that he does so because probably his father as well had trained him this way, had trained him to seek after God, Jared had. And his father names him as, you know, dedicated to this. And so he has a son, Methuselah. And I think I've broken that down for you before and shown you that Methuselah actually means something, and that Enoch had something in mind when he named him Methuselah. And sometimes, you know, because Methuselah died in the year of the flood, people are kind of like, well, did he die in the flood? Well, you know, he may have, but I don't necessarily see any indication why we should think that he died in the flood. In fact, I think the greater indication is that the year that he died was the sign that the flood was coming. That would be the year that the flood would come because of what his name meant. And that is the issuing forth of judgment. The dart is coming, is the is the what his name means. And so it's the coming forth, you see, of judgment. So when he died, that was the coming forth of judgment of God in the flood upon the earth. And I'm telling you that because when we go back here, we go, well, Cain names his son Enoch, and that sounds good. And it is a good name. But there's some indication that Cain's dedicated son that's being called that, not because he's dedicated him to God. Well, notice here. He says that he called his son dedicated, and then he built a city and called the name of the city after the name of his son Enoch. And so he is most probably saying, I have dedicated a place for my people, for my legacy. I've dedicated a place that I can build a city and we can be provided for and we can have protection. You know, Enoch or Cain seemed to really be concerned about that. And he seemed to be concerned about protection. And that seems to be fed down through the line, as we'll see in just a little bit as well. You know, being able to take care of yourself, not getting hurt, getting as most out of life as you can, living as long as you can, you know, making sure that no one, you know, brings you any harm. And then we see that not only then does he name the city after his son, that Enoch then names his sons. And so it says in verse 18, and unto Enoch was born Irad. And Irad means fugitive. Don't know, wonder why, I don't get it, but he names his son fugitive. Maybe, you know, he's thinking back to his father and how that his father was a fugitive in a sense and out here wandering in the world. But isn't that interesting? Why this idea of a fugitive? And then we find that he has another son and Irad then has a son, Mehujael. And we find then that his name means smitten by God. Or it also means wipe out. Or the idea that they come up with smitten by God is because it means to cleanse, to wipe out. And so it can also be interpreted wipe out God. In other words, just remove God from the equation. Remove God from our lives. Not saying that that's what he intended necessarily, and don't know exactly which one he meant. But smitten of God is one idea. In other words, they saw themselves just being cursed by God, and that they would just remove God from their vocabulary almost, in a sense, even though they still use the name of God, even in these names. And just like any time you see, you know, especially in a Hebrew name, the word El somewhere in the name, at the end of a name especially, that has something to do, has some tie with God, generally. But the word El for Elohim of God, El of God, just means powerful, mighty, mighty one. And so that's something that is used to describe God in a name that God uses, you know, even to describe himself. And so were they wanting to wipe God from their memories or their lives? Well, you know, we can see how much today do people want to wipe out the name of God? How much do people not want to hear the name of God? How much do people want to remove the name of God from everything that they can and sue and consider themselves, you know, offended by the name of God? So is that as well what Cain's family, you know, was seeking to do? And then we have that he had a son, Methushael. And we see then that Methushael is the meaning of who is of God. Or it literally says, man, I am man. Who is God? And so it could as well just be a challenge to God. And it could also just be, I am man and I am strong, or I am God. And so they're setting themselves up to be God, setting themselves up to be totally removed from God. And and reject God. So isn't that interesting that these are the names that they are given and that they then go by and consider? So we also look at Cain's record of ancestry. And it's interesting that the last of his ancestry that is recorded of specific individuals is Lamech, and he is, you know, a polygamist. And with that, things really deteriorate. And we notice then that not only is this the last record of Cain's ancestry, but we have a statement over here in Genesis chapter 6, verses 1 and 2, that by the time of Noah, by the days of Noah, when God had been seeing this coming, as Enoch had prophesied that God would come with 10,000s of His holy ones in judgment, we see then that it is described like this. And it came to pass, when men began to multiply on the face of the ground, and daughters were born unto them. And so we just have men. Who are men? Well, this is Cain's family, most likely. I mean, it all fits within the context. That the sons of God. And so, who are the sons of God? Well, they probably refer back here to Enoch, and men began to call upon the name of Jehovah. And so that's the ancestry of Seth. But what happens throughout this process of time? So the ancestors of Seth, who were those that were being raised and being taught, you know, with God in mind, saw the daughters of men, that they were fair. And they took them wives of all that they chose. And so now they too then begin to emulate the world and take, like Lamech, they begin polygamy. They begin taking as many wives as they desired, as they chose to have. And that's getting to the final description of God then saying, like in verse 3 of Genesis chapter 6, and Jehovah said, "My spirit shall not strive with man forever, for he also is flesh." And so he says, "I'm not going to do this forever." And then we see in the fifth verse, "And Jehovah saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And it repented Jehovah that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him at his heart. And Jehovah said, I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the ground, both man and beast and creeping things and birds of the heavens, for it repenteth me that I have made them." But Noah found favor in the eyes of Jehovah. And so by the time we get down to this point, only one from the lineage of Seth, only one in his family, are found faithful. And all the rest have gone the way of Cain, you see. And so, as Cain's record ends there, in a sense it also ends there with Seth's record as far as the majority of them. And so when we look at this, we find that he also then makes laws for his benefit, you know, thinking that he has the right to do and to expect, you know, whatever he wants. He imagines for himself greatness. He says to his wife, Ada, and to Scylla, "Hear my voice, you wives of Lamech. Hearken unto my speech. For I have slain a man for wounding me, and a young man for bruising me. If Cain shall be avenged sevenfold, then Lamech 70 and 7-fold. And so the idea there isn't that God's going to revenge me, but no, he's going to revenge himself. He says, if that's what's going to happen to anyone who had taken Cain's life, then it's going to be 70 times that for anyone who tries to mess with me. And it's interesting as well that this is also coming off of one of his sons who has invented instruments of war, weapons. As we noticed this morning, he is the forger of every cutting instrument of brass and of iron. Of every cutting instrument. And so maybe he feels very powerful now. He doesn't have to throw stones and just, you know, try to take a stick or a cane or something and hit someone. He doesn't just have to hit somebody over the head, you know, with a rock like, you know, Cain had done. but he, you know, has fine weapons in which he can defend himself. You know, he can take care of himself. And so you see this deterioration throughout, you know, Cain's family. We find that he introduced polygamy, and then even the sons of Seth that they take on, and they, you know, become polygamous. And we find that what they do is they destroy marriage. They do not, you know, necessarily have to divorce as we think of it, but they can simply just, you know, marry another and have as many as they want. We see then, just as even today, that there are many who do not maybe want divorce in their marriage, but they don't always have the power to maintain the marriage, because if the other person wants to leave, they can just leave. And now, of course, you know, the law makes it even easier with no fault. If somebody doesn't want to be married, doesn't make any difference if the other person wants to be married or not. They can just leave and break up that marriage. And what you see then here, as they took polygamy, that you had the same kinds of sins and the problems within the family that you have with divorce, that's just repeated over and over again. And that is, as he says in Romans 1, you don't have that natural affection. And so most, not all, but by far most cases of abuse in a family, whether it's sexual or mental or physical, it's because that's not the natural child of one of the spouses in the family. I mean, statistics just bear that out. And so you have then the breakdown of the family, and you have then, you know, children that don't have direction and don't know where to go and don't know what's, you know, going on and do not have, you know, this training. And so we have this deterioration of the family, have this pride and selfishness and even murder and this arrogance of his own self-power. You know, I'm all powerful. I can revenge of myself 70 times over what anyone else can. And so we find pride and selfishness and murder also come from the family of Cain, even though they were quite progressive in the ways that they had, you know, developed and grown and the things that they had discovered and invented and put together. But it's having an effect just like it would in any people, in any culture that removes the idea of God, takes God out of the picture. And so by the time that we get to Noah, we find that God is sickened with this arrogance and the ignorance of his creation. And he says, you know, I will destroy man, and it repents me that I have ever created man. Even the descendants of Seth, with the exception of one family, as we know already, Noah, has been so influenced by the enticements of this sinful life that they no longer have any repulsion of it. They just gladly accept it. They no longer warn about it among themselves and of their children. And so it's not just the individual, but how it decays the family in seeking to find, you know, justification for what they love, for what they want. And then that rots the morals of those who do not, you know, who practice these things. And then it begins to even to rot the morals of those who do not practice the same sins, but do not then, you know, rebuke those. They consent to them. And so like in Romans chapter 1 and verse 32, then he says, "Hey, knowing the ordinance of God, that they that practice such things are worthy of death, not only do the same, but also consent with them that practice them." And so we find that we try to find defense for, you know, the breakup of the family throughout, you know, our society and throughout culture. And we ease the laws by which that we can break up, you know, the family. And we ease then the laws by which, you know, we can abandon and not provide and take care of, and we make it easier then for one who is abandoned. And you know, most certainly, I'm not saying that we shouldn't, but what we have is then, well, if you don't want to take care of your family and you want to just run off and you want to create a new family, don't worry. We collectively, as the state, as the governing powers, we will, you know, feed your family, and we will house your family, and we will take care of them. And so you see, we're finding consent even if we don't practice those things. We are, you know, enabling those things. And so we find that many then are growing up with abuse, both physical and financial and sexual, and they don't have any clue what it is that God sought to create in the family. That's the first thing God put together when He created man. And its deterioration destroyed that first world and destroys cultures ever since. And so we find then that all of this begins to just simply be accepted. Though only 2% of the population of the United States is considered homosexual, more than 50% agree to it. More than 50%, you know, supports that. And so, and today, and actually that's, I haven't looked up a new figure. I think that with the way that things are now, that it's probably much more than 50%. But that's what you still hear quoted a lot, even, you know, in news programs and such. And so it is the consent to the breaking down of the morals of a society, the morals of a culture, the morals of a people. And that's going the way of Cain. So where does all that end? Well, that's not what I intended to cover, but we do have, just as we sang already tonight, as well as this morning, that someday we will all give an account. All people will give an account of these things. You know, when that will be, I don't know, and it really doesn't make any difference if it's 1,000 years from now in one sense, because no one that's living today, it's going to take them 1,000 years to find out what the judgment is. That's discovered upon our death. And none of us even live nearly as long as they did in the days of Cain. And so it's going to be discovered soon enough. So God's given us these lessons. He's provided, like I said, all of this information. And it's kind of like, you know, you fed us a lot of things here, God, that we're not sure, you know, what is the usefulness of it. But I think we can kind of say, why don't we just, in a pond of goldfish, be a bluefish? Be different. Don't be what everyone else is. Do not conform to this world. The Scriptures repeatedly use that idea in different ways. Don't be pressed into the world's mold. Don't so desire these things that are such temporary nature that you allow it, you know, to rob you of your eternal stake in heaven, you know, your eternal soul for what? For how many few short years that you might try to pursue them here in this life. And then, as Jesus said, as we talked about a contrast to that this morning from the Sermon on the Mount, that really that's what Jesus is saying on the Sermon on the Mount. You can have everything that you need to have. You can have the joy of this life. You can have the joy of the elements of this world even. You can enjoy those. In fact, you can enjoy them to their fullest, even more so, if you will seek God first. If you'll make God first instead of these things, then, he says, you will learn the true satisfaction and the true joy, and of course, in the end, eternal life.
Well, anybody have anything more to say? And if not, let's use the invitation song. We all know what this is about. So if there's any this evening that would like to accept Jesus' invitation, we would encourage you to use this opportunity to come as we stand and sing.